just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we're here at a new time slot, bright and early on the West Coast, 9 a.m. This is where we'll be every week from here on out, as long as we know, or as long as we can. We will be here at 9 o'clock. And this is quite a move because we had been at 5 o'clock p.m. Pacific time for the last 10 years. So this is quite a nice change. As usual, though, Writers on Writing will feature authors, editors, poets, and literary agents, everyone who's anyone in publishing, discussing, talking about books and writing and all the goings-on in the publishing industry. Today, my guests are Brenda Copeland and Melissa Plout. First up is Brenda Copeland, who's an executive editor at Hyperion. Hi, Brenda.
Hello, Barbara. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Great to have you on our premiere morning show.
Well, I'm so glad it's not so early in New York, though. It's at the crack of lunch here. So.
Oh, yes. Well, it's good to talk to you again. And As we did before, for those who didn't hear you when you were on a couple years ago, would you talk a little bit about how you became an editor?
Oh, sure. I probably have the most winding, let's say, route to publishing of anybody that I know. I'm really a classic late bloomer, and I've been in publishing now for a little over 10 years. I'm originally from Toronto, and I came to New York 11 years ago to do graduate work at NYU, and I hated graduate school, and I'm sorry, I know you're on a college radio show, but I really hated it. I found that, you know, the joy of reading books was just so sort of taken away from me, and it was all about theory and competition, and it just you know, it just didn't feel good. It certainly wasn't right for me. So after that first year, I sent letters to all the publishers in town offering myself to work for free. You know, actually, we'll work for books was kind of more like it. And I became an intern at Simon & Schuster, and I absolutely loved it. I mean, there, the first question that anybody asked was, who is going to read this book? You know, did you like this book? Is this a good book? So really basic questions, and questions that I still ask every day and sometimes find the answers to. So after that, I went back to grad school, and then I went to Simon & Schuster as an editorial assistant and sort of worked my way up, which is pretty much really the only way it's done.
So what do you handle? What sort of material comes in the door that's for you?
Well, that... Gosh, that's a good question. You know, I am sort of determinedly eclectic, I like to say, as Hyperion is, really. I do a lot of memoir, which I really love to do. I published a book just a couple of months ago called The Late Bloomer's Revolution, which obviously has great appeal for me. And that book, the writer, her name is Amy Cohen. You know, she just sparkles. She's very funny, but she's got such depth and pathos, too. You know, it's sadness in that book. And what I loved about it, you know, there are a lot of books about sort of quirky Jewish women in New York dating a string of sort of the wrong guy until she finds the one. Well, there's definitely that component to this, but it's much more than that. And in this particular book, Amy actually doesn't find the one, which I thought was great, because that's sort of true for so many of us. So I guess I look for books that speak to me and that speak to, you know, that large audience that we're all looking for. Fiction, nonfiction. I do some practical self-help. I did a book on eating disorders earlier this year, which I'm very proud of. I'm doing a book now called, we're still in the final edits, called I'm Right, You're Wrong, Now What? And that's right. I love that book.
Good
because
title.
The title really announces what it's about. And I've actually found it very helpful for myself in working on that book, because it teaches you, you know, how to deal with these impasses that we all come across. And it's not just about difficult people. In fact, it's not about dealing with difficult people, because let's face it, nobody really thinks that they are difficult, but it's with dealing with difficult situations. So it's fabulous, and I think it's fair to say that I personally get something out of each and every book that I publish, which is really nice.
So
that's my grad school.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM in Irvine. Well, that book that you just mentioned too, it had a great title, and it raises the question about titles and how important are they. When they come in, when a project comes into you from an agent, I would think the first step is seeing the agent's name and knowing whether you like the agent, work well with the agent. I don't know. Is that a part of it, or do you go straight to the project?
It is a part of it, because it's very much, you know, a teamwork, you know, between the editor and the agent and the author. There's no doubt about that. And also the agent's reputation, her reputation in the industry at large, and your, you know, sort of personal reputation with that person. You know, how have you worked with them in the past? Have you had good dealings? Have you found them to be reasonable, and or have you found them to be unreasonable? Because, you know, that certainly happens too. So my thinking in terms of just the agent's role is, I mean, I love agents, and some of my best friends are agents, truly. But I really do see it as a collaboration, and there are times when, you know, the agent has to make the process easier for the author. Not necessarily make the process easier for me, but I would hope that the agent doesn't make things more difficult for me, you know. But a good agent is worth her weight in gold, absolutely. So, yes, of course, when a project comes in, to know who that agent is very important. And a good agent will give me a heads up, too, will give me a call and say, look, you know, I know you do this, this, and that. I think you might like this. You know, you tell me. So that's sort of part of it. I mean, you have the agent, just as I need to know the agent has to know me, what my likes and dislikes are, what my list is about. But title, as you mentioned, title is so important. It's so important. And when the title isn't right, which often happens, it can be a signal that there's a problem with the book itself, in that it doesn't have the focus that it needs to have.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, what will happen is, if you have in mind a particular title for a book, and the author has another title in mind, that's not simply a matter of, oh, well, we disagree on the title. It's very often an indicator that we disagree on the vision for the book itself. So that can be a real warning bell. So, and of course, title has to, you know, a title can do many things. It, in the case of I'm Right, You're Wrong, Now What, I love that book because that title, because it broadcasts what the book is about and what the reader can hope to get from it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Other titles are more provocative, or they tease, you know, The Late Bloomer's Revolution. Well, you know, what is that about? But that phrase, late bloomer,
right.
Boy, is that ever enticing, you know?
And especially put with the word revolution.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. We had actually toyed with the idea of doing The Late Bloomer's Guide to Life or The Late Bloomer's Handbook or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so glad we didn't, because it would have been wrong, you know, because, well, firstly, there have been a spate of books, you know, Guide to Life or Handbook or whatever, you know. So what we're doing, if we take that, is sort of signaling to the author, to the reader, I should say, to the book buyer, that this is sort of that type of book. And the fact is, this isn't that type of book. This is something new and of its own. And we've had great success with this book, and people love it. You know, it's in its third printing now. It's really doing well. So I'm kind of hoping that in the next couple of years we'll see other books called Revolution, you know, because that's what happens. You know, you follow a track, and then you go off on your own, and then other people start to follow you.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I want to get back to something you just touched on earlier. Well, you sort of breezed over, as you should have, which is what you handle and or what you like to see, what you like to work
right.
on. And you mentioned fiction and you mentioned memoir.
Yes.
And I started thinking of an email I received the other day from a writer who said, more and more agents are not handling fiction, so what do we do? There are editors that handle fiction, but it seems like every agent is handling less and less. Do you find that memoir is taking over sort of fiction in terms of, I don't know, popularity or what you see more of? Because there, you know, nonfiction agents will handle memoir, but
right.
they won't handle fiction, of course.
That's really an interesting question. And my honest answer is I don't know, but I can certainly touch it. I certainly do more nonfiction than fiction. That's not the case for every editor, not at all. At our house here, we do I'd say 75% nonfiction, 25% fiction. So, you know, different houses and different imprints within those houses, you know, do a different ratio of fiction to nonfiction. But the truth is, most books that are sold are nonfiction. And in terms of fiction, you know, it's getting harder and harder to find the audience. I'm not really sure why that is. I think part of it can be, you know, what we're all struggling with, and I don't actually think that this has to be a bad thing. I think it's just an adjustment. But we're all struggling with, you know, what's happened in the last 10 years or so in terms of what is just out there in order to, you know, get people's attention. I spend a lot of time online now, as most people do, you know. So the time that I could be reading fiction or whatever, I'm online. I think people always need stories. I believe that in my heart. I couldn't be in this business unless I believed that. But there are so many ways to come to stories, you know, and certainly memoir is a beautiful way of, you know, making the story of yourself. And you and I have talked in the past about, you know, the difference, you know, what is fiction in fact and what is fact in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really something that's hard to come to terms with. I think what happens in fiction is that, in terms of the market for fiction, you know, there are writers who have a following, and they maintain that following. You know, there's the Stephen Kings, there's the Janet Ivanovich, you know, there's Jennifer Weiner, you know, really, really good fiction writers in very different genres, and people sort of tend to follow them. But it's really hard to make to get that sort of big breakout book,
mm-hmm.
and for people to come and follow you. So, for example, I know with Jennifer Weiner, her big book, of course, was Good in Bed, and there was a real, you know, what we call a real hook to that. It wasn't just that it was a beautiful, a well-written story. It just wasn't just that it was lively and, you know, good character and dialogue. It was that, you know what, the protagonist here is a size 14.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't that a new thing,
right.
You know? So we really need to have that hook. Now, something else that we also talk about, fiction and nonfiction, you know, is the idea of a platform, just, you know, who is the writer, you know, who is the author. Now, I think one of the reasons why nonfiction is easier to sell is because people who write nonfiction often have more to offer to a publisher to help us get the word out. You know, sometimes people who write nonfiction, like my author, Dr. Javier Amador, who wrote, you know, I'm Right, You're Wrong, Now What? I mean, he's on TV a lot. He's constantly speaking to different groups, you know, about the issue of conflict resolution and so forth. So he has sort of a following. But imagine, you know, you're just a lonely writer toiling in your room, you know, writing the great American novel. You know, maybe six people know about this. So it's harder to get traction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we look for sort of that other thing. The book that did very nicely and is continuing to do nicely for Viking, The Memory Keeper's Daughter.
Yes.
Beautiful book, really great storytelling, strong story. But from what I understand, that book did nicely in hardcover, but it really got its traction in paperback. And it's because there's a character in that novel with Down syndrome, and people who have children in their lives who are affected with Down syndrome really caught on to this novel and talked about it amongst themselves. So that was sort of the built-in platform there
mm-hmm.
that took over, you know, from just the sort of the limits of fiction. What I mentioned earlier in terms of the internet and how, you know, we can look at this either as a real threat and a challenge or an opportunity in it as a challenge, I really, really, really choose the latter because, firstly, it's, you know, just to look at it as a threat is just too scary and I wouldn't get out of bed. But one of the things that I love about the internet is the idea that, you know, we try in a lot of ways, you know, publishers and movie makers and, you know, to get buzz going and whatever, but the fact is you really can't replace that organic buzz that happens. You know, it's sort of like talking to somebody over the picket fence, although it's a keyboard instead of a picket fence these days.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really great. And there is, you know, for all the cynicism that is out there online, once you get somebody's trust and loyalty, I think, you know, you can really go places with that. So it's exciting, and people do talk a lot online about what they're reading.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting what you say about The Memory Keeper's Daughter and people who have Down syndrome children in their lives were attracted to the book and talked it up, because I just heard over the weekend, I was at the West Hollywood Book Fair, and Kim Dower, who's a book publicist, moderated the panel I sat on, and she said that as a publicist these days with fiction, she is coming up with topics or pitch lines that she can pitch novelists to talk shows, because while it's easy to book nonfiction writers because they have something to talk about in the world, hosts think that novelists really have nothing to talk about except the novel, which, you know, as we know, is not true, but... It's so not true, but now to have topics, you know, okay, The Memory Keeper's Daughter, well, the author can talk about this, and can talk about children, you know, with Downs.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, also, you know, how did the writer come to it? I mean, does the writer have a child in her family, you know, or you know, just, it's a shame that we think that, you know, it's fact and it's fiction, and fiction, you know, this invented story doesn't really have any application for our real lives. It's such a shame because it's so not true, you know, and what better way to explore things that we're, you know, unfamiliar or uncomfortable with or perhaps even just frightened of than in fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is interesting, though. I should talk to the author and see how that book came about. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM in Irvine. We're also online streaming live around the world at KUCI.org. So if you're listening to the podcast, when this is podcast in a week or so, you can always listen live at 9 a.m. Pacific time on KUCI.org. I'm with Brenda Copeland, editor at Hyperion. And I wanted to ask you, and this is something that comes up a lot too, and I know what you're going to say, but I have to ask you anyway, because
I've just shifted in my chair.
They don't believe me, so I have to ask you. Maybe they believe me, but anyway. A lot of new writers think that they can go directly to the publisher. And why go through an agent when I can go straight to the publisher and have more control over where my book goes, who my book goes to, blah-de-blah. And, of course, what I say is, big publishers, it's not going to happen.
It's so not going to happen. And, you know, I would just ask these people, you know, would they sell their house without a realtor?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's kind of the same thing. Firstly, that's not to say that a lot of people don't come to me directly, but I cannot deal. I'm such a diva. I simply can't deal directly with authors. Firstly, for Hyperion, and as for many other publishers, actually, we have a pretty strong policy about it. So that's one thing. But that aside, I'm not talking about my perspective, talking about the writer's perspective. Firstly, the writer doesn't know me. The writer doesn't really know publishing houses either. I remember, you know, when I was offering myself to publishers for free to work that summer, I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I mean, and I thought this was a sensible thing. I'll go to the bookstore and I'll look at my favorite books and see who the publishers are. And I called them and I called them and I called them, and I had no idea that somebody, you know, how many publishers ended up being Random House. You know, I had no idea how many of them were actually owned by the same company.
Mm-hmm.
Same when I went to call Simon & Schuster. So that's sort of part of it. You know, publishing, it's a business, absolutely, but it's a business of taste. And you really do need to know the taste of the person that you're sending your book to. You absolutely do. And as a writer, you know, again, toiling away in your attic, you just have absolutely no way to know what my tastes are. You know, to know what I've published in the past, to know what I'm looking to publish in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sure, you can Google me, and sure, you can find out things that way, but it's not reliable.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, publishing is a really interesting business in that, you know, it used to have these gentlemanly roots. You know, I picture maybe 30 years ago, you know, the publishing halls were filled with, you know, men wearing bow ties and horn rim glasses. I don't know, but it's, you know, we're owned by large corporations these days. And, you know, I've completely lost my train of thought.
Well, anyway, about the author coming directly to you.
So we have these sort of Byzantine roots in this, you know, sort of gentleman's business of before, and yet we're owned by and large corporations, which frankly I think can be a very good thing because it gives us a lot of muscle, it gives us a lot of structure, and it, you know, I mean, it's very hard for small publishers these days. But anyway, the point is, with our roots in, you know, publishing still is very much has that sort of gentleman's agreement about it. You know, we agree on deals, we put contracts into motion, but the editor and the writer will often start working on a book long before a contract is in place and before, you know, a check has been cut. You know, there's often little things.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really, it's very much in many ways a good faith business. And, you know, it's going to be hard for somebody who doesn't have industry support in the form of an agent to know that. And there are, you know, many things that are industry standards that might seem silly to other people, but you need to have somebody on your side, an agent advocating for you and explaining to you the ways of the business, saying, you know what, this is something we shouldn't give the publisher, this is a right that we should withhold for ourselves, but this is something absolutely, you know, don't worry about this. This is how this works, this is how that works, so to go on. So that's another thing. Now, first, what else to say about the agent is the agent is going to know the right editor for the book, or, you know, potentially the right editor for the book. So that, you know, speaks volumes. And frankly, an agent will probably get you more money.
Mm-hmm. That's so true.
You know, yeah, there's no doubt about it. And you have worked so hard on your book for so long. Why wouldn't you engage the services of an ally, of somebody who is professional in this business? You know, because there is your career as a writer, and there is your career as an author, and they're not the same things.
Mm-hmm. Great answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Even though you knew what I was going to say, it was a great answer.
Well, you're so articulate, and it really does spell it out for writers, because they think the 15% is major, and yet,
sure,
yeah,
but, and it is.
But usually you won't get that sort of deal for yourself without an agent. So
right.
The agent pays for him or herself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also, you know, there are going to be, you know, there's the possibility, let me say, of points in the relationship with you and your publisher, you and your editor, where things will go awry.
Mm-hmm.
It could be something on the timing, on the scheduling. It could be on the format. You know, your publisher may want you to go to a paperback original, but you've, you know, had your heart set on hardcover, and you see this sort of a straight-to-video kind of thing, you know. And there are going to be little tussles. How much better is it for you to be able to step back and let your agent and your editor duke it out, you know?
Exactly.
I wish I had I really do, you know? Somebody who could call up and say, and then you get to be the nice person in the background, you know? I think it's perfect. I think we should all have agents from age about 8 onward.
Oh, this half hour has flown by, and we have another minute left, and I wonder if you have any pearls of wisdom for, any more pearls of wisdom for the writers listening.
Oh my gosh, yes, I would love to say, if you want to be a good writer, you need to be a good reader and buy a book today.
You know,
that is
so true.
But it really is true. It is true. And you know what? Let me plug a book that has nothing to do with me. I picked this up at the Ottawa airport in the summer, and I absolutely love it. And it's got the, talk about titles. How about this? Lullabies for Little Criminals.
Hmm.
And the author's name is Heather O'Neill, and it is exquisite, and it's a paperback original.
Interesting. That's great. No, I love to hear what editors and agents
right.
are reading.
Yeah, it's so nice to hear. But this is an undiscovered gem, absolutely.
Hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Once again for being on and taking
How
the
fun.
Time.
And now I'm going to have my lunch, and you're just going to have your breakfast.
I'm going to have another guest first.
That sounds great. Thank you, Barbara.
Thanks a lot, Brenda.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was Brenda Copeland, editor at Hyperion Publishers in New York, a generous, generous editor and wonderful, wonderful woman. Stay tuned. When we get back, we will be with Melissa Plaut, author of Hack. So stay with us. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI-FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. So if it's a couple of weeks from now and you're listening to the podcast, which you can find by going to my website at penonfire.com and clicking on the radio tower on the left side of the page, you'll be at the radio page and there are details there for how to find the podcast. In any case, if you're listening in the future, you can always listen live wherever you sit on the planet at kuci.org. We also broadcast via iTunes. Go to public radio. You'll find KUCI, click on it, and you will be immediately engaged with the show and all shows here at KUCI. At KUCI.org, you can find a schedule of other public affairs shows as well as alternative music shows. The station is wonderful that way. Lots of stuff you won't find on mainstream radio. And this show has been here for 10 years and used to be at 5 o'clock Pacific time. Now we're at 9 a.m. Pacific time every Wednesday. So please tune in again. And I guess that's it for now, but we're going to bring on our next guest, Melissa Plaut. She's author of Hack: How I Stopped Worrying About What to Do with My Life and Started Driving a Yellow Cab. She was born in 1975 and grew up in the suburbs of New York City. After college, she held a series of office jobs until, at the age of 29, she began driving a yellow cab. A year later, she started writing New York Hack, blogspot.com, a blog about her experiences behind the wheel. And within several months, the blog was receiving several thousand hits a day. Let's bring her on. Melissa Plaut, hi.
Hi.
Great to have you on. Will you talk a little bit more about that, how the book was an evolution from the blog?
Yeah, sure. I had started the blog a year into my cab driving career, and that, it initially started as just like a little thing of pictures for friends. And they asked me for more words. I just wanted to show them what I was seeing in the cab. And so then I just started writing more and more after each shift, and it would be like 4 or 5 in the morning, and I didn't really have time to sort of be insecure and question myself. And I got more and more comfortable with it, and eventually there were just a lot of long stories on there, and the blog sort of became somewhat popular, I guess, you know, in cyberspace somehow. Mm-hmm. And once I got a bunch of press, I got approached by kind of agents and editors asking whether or not I wanted to, you know, write a book, you know, just if I had considered the possibility. And I wasn't so sure at first, and that what I realized is that I did want to write a book, and I didn't want it to be sort of a collection of blog posts. What I wanted to do was something that I would never have done on the internet, which was just sort of get more personal and actually talk about my experiences in the cab, as opposed to just this is what happened. So, you know, on the blog, you know, I just would say, this is what happened, and, you know, I would kind of complain about things and rant and rave. But people commented too immediately for me to want to get vulnerable and intimate. So the book sort of became the outlet for that, for being able to actually tell the whole story and just be really honest about what was happening.
That's great that you were pursued. That's so unusual and so wonderful.
Yes, I was very lucky.
Well,
I really was.
So once you, did you choose among agents, among editors? How did that go?
I had met with a couple of people that had, you know, sort of approached me randomly. And then once the ball was rolling and I sort of said, you know what, this is something I want to do, then I sort of asked around for recommendations from friends who, you know, the agent that I am with now is, came through a recommendation. And then the editor of my book had, he edited a friend of mine's book, Girl Bomb, by Janice Earlbaum. And her and I have known each other since 1999. And so So when all this was happening, she said, "You know, maybe you want to talk to Bruce and see." You know, she's like, "I love him. You might. He might love you. We'll see." You know, and so we had met, and I mean, obviously, it wasn't like a done deal. I wrote a proposal and we sent it out to everybody, but he bought it in a preempt. You know, he saw it 24 hours before all the other editors and bought it before they really even got a chance to consider it.
Mm-hmm. So, interesting.
Yeah, it was very lucky. I mean, it was sort of like a dream come true.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
yeah. I mean, that is a dream come true. I think for writers to not have to go through the headache and the heartache of looking for an agent and then hoping that the agent finds a publisher and then finding the right publisher and finding the right editor and you know, it can be endless, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing was, it's ironic because I had pretty much given up on any kind of writing, which is why I started driving a cab. I was like, you know what? I can't do this anymore. You know, I didn't think I was good at it. I had been writing copy for an ad agency, and I was defeated, you know, and I just gave up. I said, all right, you know what? I'm going to move on. I'm going to have adventures. I'm going to live a different kind of life. I'm not going to pursue this sort of career type of thing. I'm not going to try and write. I'm not going to try and do all these things that are kind of making me miserable. And so I started driving a cab. And then after a year, I was like, wow, you know, I really do want to talk about what's happening in my life, which is so this became interesting to me. And so somehow I sort of found my way back to it. It was very organic and you know, without any kind of thought towards. That's the thing. I didn't want to show it to, like, I wasn't trying to write for people other than my friends and family who I knew already liked me. I think once you start writing for the public, you know, and you want people to like you, of course, that changes it. So I had already been in this groove of, like, well, I could say whatever I want because they're not going to reject me, you know.
Yeah.
They're going to still like me, my friends. And so when it started being other people reading the blog, I had to sort of tune that out in the beginning and pretend that it was just, you know, like my best friend and a couple other people and, you know, maybe my dad or I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That really helped with it all, I think.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Melissa Plout, author of Hack, How I Stopped Worrying About What to Do with My Life and Started Driving a Yellow Cab. Published by Villard, which is an imprint of Random House.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting what you say that you gave up writing, and then your blog and your writing started just taking off, because it does seem sometimes that we have to kind of give up this obsession with publishing and obsession with, you know, sounding a certain way or being a certain way. And when you finally let go of that, often that's when things start falling into place and you find your topic, you find your voice, and the writing comes together.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened for me. I don't think I could have gone in. I don't think any of this would have happened had I gone into it with these goals in mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know what I think it is I would have just been, like I was saying before, I would have just been too self-conscious and it would have come out in the writing. I was helped by the fact that in the blog I got a lot of discipline and practice doing it, you know, and just sort of writing for no one or for my friends or something. But I was also doing it so late at night / early in the morning in such a state of exhaustion, I really just didn't have time to be self-conscious and insecure and worry about, are people going to like this? It was just sort of like, here it is. This is what happened tonight. And I would go over it and read it and try and fix mistakes or explain something better. But it wasn't like, it was very rough, and I was okay with letting it be rough, you know, and I'd wake up in the morning and reread it, or the next day in the afternoon reread it, and maybe kind of tinker a little, but nothing too crazy. And so I think when, if I had been more self-conscious about, like, trying to achieve something with the writing rather than just doing it, it never would have happened.
Well, that's a great point, too, because some of the best writing does come out of either come out of you when you've just woken up, or as you say, when you're just exhausted and you're relaxed and you're just not gonna, you just don't have the energy to worry.
Yeah. Well, that's how I wrote the book is, I didn't want to, you know, write the book at 5 a.m, but, what I did with the book was I woke up and every day I just wrote in the morning. It was sort of impossible for me to sort of go around and do my day and run errands and take care of business and then come home and write at 3:30 in the afternoon. I couldn't do that. But I would wake up and I would make a cup of coffee and I would just sit down and that would be my writing time, you know, and I would write for as long as I could. Sometimes it would go, you know, all through the day with little breaks here and there, but usually it was just maybe 3 hours, 2-3 hours in the morning and until I sort of ran out of steam and started kind of being preoccupied with, you know, I have to do laundry or, you know, whatever errands and, you know, the tedious tidbits of life that I had to take care of. So.
Well, will you read to us?
What was that?
Will you read to us? Read
oh,
from
yeah,
Heck.
Of course.
That would be great.
Okay. I'm just going to read a really short section that is actually not taking place in the taxi cab, but at the garage, sort of during the shape up, which is, you know, the age old taxi garage thing where you just sort of wait around for your cab and
okay.
sort of.
And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. Melissa Plouffe's about to read from Hack, How I Stopped Worrying About What to Do with My Life and Started Driving a Yellow Cab.
Okay. About a month into my adventure, I met an old-time driver who had become one of my closest cab-driving friends at the garage. He was an insanely tall, lanky, scruffy, middle-aged guy wearing jeans and a plaid button-down shirt. When I walked in, he was standing at the Ms. Pac-Man machine, trying to beat his own high score. I always thought it was funny, the very cab-specific symbolism of Ms. Pac-Man. A yellow disc speeds around a neon-lit grid, eating white dots and getting chased by ghosts. I watched him play for a few minutes, and when the game over screen appeared, he turned and introduced himself to me. His name was Daniel, and he'd been driving a cab since 1979. He was incredibly nice, and when I told him I was a little drained from the job, he gently patted my shoulder and in a comforting tone said, "Don't worry, it'll get easier, I promise." Daniel liked to work only on the Upper East Side. He was keyed into the area better than any global positioning system could ever be, and he tried his best to stay there for his entire shift. He also loved to get fares to the airports, and over time we held countless debates on whether or not it was worth it to sit in the taxi hold lots waiting for a fare back. Of all the cabbies I'd met so far, Daniel was definitely the sanest. While we were waiting, Paul the crazy Romanian was dispatching. As the day drivers pulled in and gassed up, Paul would pick up the next license in the stack and call the driver's name over the loudspeaker. Each conversation at the garage was punctuated with interruptions like, "Victor the criminal, you're up," and "Morris the terrorist, get your butt over here," all spoken in a thick Romanian accent so that each consonant had a hard edge. The din of voices lulled for a second as everyone tilted their ears to make sure it wasn't their name being called. And the guy who was called peeled off from his conversation, picked up his license and trip sheet at the dispatcher's window, and went to work. Day drivers were slowly trickling in, names were being called, and Daniel and I were standing around talking when another driver, Harvey, showed up. This day he was wearing black stretch pants, the top of which produced a horizontal line that starkly divided his body into upper and lower portions, as well as a pink turtleneck, pink nail polish, and red lipstick. Daniel turned to him and said with a good-natured chuckle, "Harvey, I don't understand. Your nail polish doesn't match your lipstick. Why not?" Harvey replied in his deep, almost frog-throated voice, "Ah, yes, but my nail polish matches my shirt, and my lipstick matches my blush. You clearly don't know anything about female attire, my friend." Daniel said, "Well, you look beautiful." Harvey answered, "Thank you." Then he turned to me and said, "And how are you, my dear? You dying out there yet?" "Pretty much," I said. And then, "No, I'm just tired, but I'm doing okay, I think." Harvey settled into a teacherly tone, saying, "Well, you have to think of it this way. You're the captain, and the passengers are just your cargo. Unfortunately, most people don't see us that way. They like to be the boss, and you their hireling. He paused and then said, my advice, get out of this while you still have your sanity. It's the worst job you'll ever do. To be frank, I'm surprised you've stuck it out for this long already. This annoyed me, yet I was happy that I'd proven him wrong. And I realized that even though I didn't necessarily like Harvey, I found myself caring about what he thought of me. And that annoyed me the most. I was about to offer him some non-reply, some type of, well, here I am, non-answer, when over the loudspeaker came, Daniel, my boyfriend. Daniel said, that's me. Okay, guys, knock him dead out there. To which Harvey replied, I always try, but my aim is a little off these days.
Thank you so much. Melissa Plout reading from Hack, How I Stopped Worrying About What to Do with My Life and Started Driving a Yellow Cab, published by Villard, an imprint of Random House. Oh, what fun. You know, I meant to ask you, or I can ask you right now, did you, anybody you wrote about in the book, what did you do with that? Did you disguise people? Did you run it by them before the book was published? Did you let them know you were working on a book? How did you deal with what could possibly be an uncomfortable situation?
Most of my friends at the garage knew about the blog. Everybody at the garage pretty much found out about the blog eventually. So that sort of, you know, softened the blow, you know, because they would read it and be excited about it and, you know, kind of want to be mentioned in it from time to time. And then when the book deal happened, what was funny is I told one of the owners of the garage, I was actually at the garage when I got the news, you know, like my agent called me and I was going to the garage to work and I knew it had been sent out the day before and she called and said, you know, are you sitting down? We have a deal. And I was so excited and I didn't know what else to do so I still worked. I still drove a cab that night. But while I was at the garage, I was so happy I told one of the owners and I said, oh, I just got this insane deal. I have a book deal and it's going to come out and don't tell anybody. And then the next day everybody knew. So it was sort of out of my hands. And when I wrote it, I basically wrote the people as I knew them. And I had to go back in and change the names and some identifying characteristics because Villard didn't want to get sued.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I had to change the name of the garage, and I changed everybody's names. And, you know, like somebody may have been from Florida, but I said they're from Maine or something like that. You know, I don't even know.
Sure.
Totally remember what I changed things to at this point. But and now, you know, everybody at the garage kind of knows who's who. You know, they know who Harvey is, and they know who Lenny is, and they know, you know. And so sometimes, you know, if they're talking to me, they'll refer to themselves in their book name, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they're not that disguised, but I guess it's enough so that the publisher won't get sued.
Yeah, yeah. Well, was there ever a question in terms of writing fiction instead of a memoir?
No, I mean it was already sort of there. There was no point to mm-hmm. trying to do fiction, at least with this. You know, this was just more like, this is what had happened to me. This is the story I wanted to tell, and I couldn't really think up anything better than that.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to fictionalize this whole thing, just because that wasn't the story I wanted to tell, I guess. You know, it started so organically that it wouldn't have made sense to say, oh, all right, now I'm going to kind of take this and push it onto something else. And it didn't make sense to me to do that.
Mm-hmm. Do you still drive a cab?
I do. In fact, I just drove Monday night. It was a terrible shift.
I just, you know, it's so funny because at one point I wanted to drive a cab, and I remember living in San Francisco and it was late one night and I was leaving a bar and I convinced this cabbie to let me drive his cab, and I just thought it was the most fun thing. I mean, it certainly wasn't a job and I only drove across town, but I could see where you would have come away with a million stories, that as far as jobs for writers, it could be a really interesting job.
Yeah, it's a fascinating job, and I think if, you know, if somebody was looking for, you know, if a writer was looking for characters to try and make something out of and just, you know, trying to get something that they may never have been able to invent, then it's probably the best way to sort of dip into the world and kind of get a gauge on, you know, what's going on out there and who's out there and, you know, what you can do with them. I mean, that would be, I guess if there were to be any fiction, that would be the launching point for, you know, if I were to pursue that, I could probably, you know, go mining into my experience and say, I remember this one person and they need a book. That person can drive a whole book or story or something.
Right. So, and women, just to talk about the profession just for a little bit, women are a really small percentage of the taxi force, yes?
Oh, yeah, it's about 1% or less. There are 44,000 licensed taxi drivers in New York City, and I think it's about 400 of them are women, so.
So are you ever out there worried? You know, driving around, somebody gets in your car and you go, uh-oh.
No, the only time I'm never really scared of the passengers. I'm scared of accidents or the possibility of them. There are some passengers I've had that were, you know, a little shady, a little annoying, and they maybe wanted to be intimidating. But after a point, I wasn't easily intimidated. The only time I can really think of that was kind of just scary with somebody in my cab was my first winter driving, and a guy got in, and it was still daylight. It was probably about 5:30 or something, and he was wearing a ski mask, and I thought he would remove it once he got in because it was cold out, but he left it on the entire time. And so that's when I sort of kind of fished the pepper spray out of my bag and just sort of held it just in case.
Uh-huh.
But instead he paid me and gave me a tip and thanked me and got out.
And so, he still had a ski mask on.
Yeah, he had a ski mask on the whole time. He thought nothing of it, I guess, but it was a little weird, you know. And then the only other time I was really, really scared was when a road raging driver like got out and we were stuck in traffic and he hit the window and spit on it and then he exposed himself to me as an act of aggression for whatever reason. But it was scary because actually when he was reaching into his pants I thought he was going to pull out a gun. So I don't know what was worse in the end.
Oh, dear. Well, you know, I found your book also informative in terms of the one thing I think people worry about when they're in a cab and the cab is stuck in traffic is you think that the cabbie is slowing down or getting stuck in traffic so that the fare drives up. But in fact, that I guess the meter spins slower when they're stuck and it's really optimal for a cabbie to be moving.
Yeah, I mean, it's better now than it was. I wrote the book and then, you know, it sort of changed after I had written that section explaining that. They finally increased it. It's called waiting time. So when you're, you know, going less than like, I don't know, 5 miles an hour or something, it just clicks. It doesn't count the mileage. It just clicks over by every 2 minutes or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that hadn't been increased since 1990 until December 2006. And so they finally brought it up to speed with, you know, everything else. So now it clicks over every minute instead of every 2 minutes or something. But even then, it doesn't make sense to keep you in a cab. You know, we just want to get people in and out as fast as possible because that's where the money is. You know, we'll make another tip, another $2.50 or $3 at the drop in the beginning of the fare, you know, with each person. So that 40 cents ticking up doesn't really, you know, it's sort of not worth it in that four, you know, few minutes with the extra 40, 80 cents, we could have made another $3, $4, or $5.
Sure.
You know.
Interesting. We are at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any last words for the writers who are listening, who are perhaps working their way through a memoir or a project of some sort.
I mean, I'm not sure what kind of authority I have, but I mean, I guess just to reiterate what we were talking about before, which is really just the biggest thing for me was, it's so hard, but is trying to really just not be self-conscious. And I had read, actually, right as I was finishing the book, I read a book Stephen King wrote a book called On Writing, which, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, a lot of people don't respect him, but I thought it was actually great. And what he said is to write with the door closed, literally and metaphorically. And I think that that's probably exactly what I'm trying to say, is just don't worry about what other people are going to think. Don't worry about your readers. Just write it, and then you always have time to go back and take out the embarrassing parts
later.
That's
right, that's right. Well, I appreciate it, and I appreciate your time and continued great luck on Hack.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That was Melissa Plout talking to us from New York, and her book again is Hack, How I Stopped Worrying About What to Do with My Life and Started Driving a Yellow Cab, published by Villard, an imprint of Random House. And she does have a blog, as I said, and you can check it out. It's newyorkhack.blogspot.com. All right, we are at the end of our time, and I'm going to leave you now. First, you can go to my website, which is penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower, visit the radio page, and see who's going to be on next. You can email me, and I will put you on the weekly e-list and let you know who's going to be on. The podcasts are at writersonwriting.blogspot.com or via the website. And there's more and more shows up. This one will go up in a couple of weeks at most. And we're just keeping it fresh. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Catherine Mansfield, who said, Risk anything. Care no more for the opinions of others, for those voices. Do the hardest thing on earth for you. Act for yourself. Face the truth. Thanks again for being here and listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I will see you next time. My lips, now, baby.